From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Claudio Sanchez, in for Maria Hinojosa. Today, la familia, the family. We hear about children struggling to cope when parents get deported.
I slept with her like the whole entire week because I knew she wasn't going to be with us anymore. And it was going to be my first day of middle school. So, like, I didn't want her to be gone.
And why all Americans should be worried about the education of non-white students.
Older white Americans should be the most concerned about making sure that young Latino and black children are being well educated, because it is those children in the years ahead who will be taking care of them.
Plus, the unexpected role that pets play in domestic violence situations. And the friends who become our family when we need them most. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Claudio Sanchez. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Claudio Sanchez, in for Maria Hinojosa, who's out working on a TV project premiering on PBS in October. Today, we're focusing on la familia, the family. And as the number of deportations under the Obama administration has reached record levels, 400,000 in 2012 alone, many of those deported are parents. Now, a growing number of children in the U.S. are living without their parents. Latino communities across the country have borne the brunt of these deportations, and researchers say children's mental health suffers as a result. From Bend, Oregon, Jordana Gustafson brings us the story of three kids whose mother went back to Mexico over 2 years ago.
Brian Tapia was 19 when his mother left.
When it happened at first, I used to cry all the time, every night. And usually the bathroom, you're taking a shower, I used to cry there. That was the only time I had time to.
Brian's sister, Carlene, was 11.
I slept with her, like, the whole entire week because I knew she wasn't going to be with us anymore. And it was going to be my first day of middle school. So, like, I didn't want her to be gone.
Brian's and Carlene's sister, Ashley, was 15.
I didn't want to say bye to her because that's how I am. Like, I don't like showing my feelings. So I just said bye and I went upstairs. And I seriously just wanted to die.
Brian, Carlene, and Ashley are what Luis Zayas calls orphans of deportation.
These are the children who remain in the U.S. after their parents are deported and in the care of someone else.
Zayas is a psychiatry professor at the University of Texas, Austin. He studies the effect of parental deportation on kids who are U.S. citizens.
They are very, you know, clearly and obviously distressed by their experiences, and as they recounted to us. Children reporting nightmares of coming home and going room to room and finding no one home.
For months after their mother's departure, the Tapia kids felt sad and anxious. Brian dropped out of a job training program. Ashley had trouble getting out of bed. Carlene says she missed half of sixth grade.
I would get up from class and go to the bathroom. I'll be there for 10 minutes or more, crying. It's just not easy not having a mom with you and when you're growing up.
The loss of a parent to deportation, Zaya says, can feel worse than if that parent had died. He says there's finality to death. You can grieve the loss and move on. But when a parent is deported,
that's really the difference, that the parent is gone, but they're still alive somewhere else at a distance that's been imposed by government policy.
In this case, government policy has left the Tapia kids living in a two-bedroom apartment with their grandparents, their aunt, three cousins, and five dogs. Like their mom, their cousin's father was also deported. On this Friday night, all six cousins sit in front of a widescreen TV. The older ones play with their smartphones.
Yeah. I had to update my...
Their undocumented grandmother, Micaela, sits at the dining table with tired eyes. She's just gotten home from a long day of work as a housekeeper at a local hotel.
Estoy trabajando 8 horas.
In an hour, she'll go to her next job, cleaning a store.
Y ahorita en la tarde, pues ya la noche.
Before leaving the U.S., the Tapia's mother, Liliana Ramos, was raising her children on her own. Her husband had left the family and returned to Mexico and was no longer part of their lives. But before he left, he did something that came back to haunt them, according to Silva.
Su esposo cometieron el error de que, pues, quería meter papeles.
Her husband made the mistake of wanting to apply for documents.
Pero no se dieron cuenta de las circunstancias que iba a pasar.
But they didn't realize what would happen.
Silva says the kid's dad filed an application for asylum. It was rejected, and both parents were ordered to leave the country. Their father left, but their mother stayed.
I'm sure she was thinking immigration wouldn't come after her because she had been here for so long. But after a few years, they got her at work.
Pero a los cuantos años, ella la agarraron en el trabajo.
Liliana Ramos was given 9 months to leave the country. She spent this time getting ready. She transferred custody of her two youngest over to her mother. She taught Brian to pay bills. And she tried to prepare him and Ashley to take care of Carlene. But Brian's not sure they've been good stand-ins.
She's a strong girl. She's a strong little girl. But at the same time, I feel like she needs that role model. And that's my mom, and we can't really do much. It's not the same. It's not the same.
It's difficult to determine exactly how many deportation orphans there are in the country. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says 200,000 people deported between 2010 and 2012 said they had U.S. citizen children. But the real number could be higher. Zayas and others say not everybody who's deported reports that they have children.
Well, she posted something on Facebook. Or maybe she's upstairs and going downstairs.
No. Brian, Ashley, and Carlene are trying to call their mother in Tijuana. She doesn't pick up.
Su llamada será transferida.
Well, I'm going to call her again.
The children have visited their mother in Mexico a few times. Carlene's eyes light up a little when she talks about moving there and going to high school there. But she admits she'd actually prefer something else.
My mom to come back. Yeah. I'd rather have her come back.
We'll hear more about Liliana Ramos' family later in our program as we visit her in Tijuana. Friends can be as close as family, and we need them for all sorts of things. To give us advice, to back us up, to tell us we're not crazy. And in one case, to protest against House Bill 56, a tough anti-immigration law passed in Alabama 3 years ago. That's how an unlikely friendship started.
My name is Gwendolyn Freddy. I am 30 years old, and I am both an anthropologist and an activist.
I am Fred Hammond, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Tuscaloosa. How this began was I wanted to do a rally here in Tuscaloosa. So we contacted the few leaders from the Latino community that we knew, and they all said, well, you need to speak to Gwen. I had not met Gwen before.
So we met and we eventually started getting friendly and talking to each other more. Both he and I are queer, and that's not very common here in Alabama. He's gay, I'm bi. So that was also a point of camaraderie. That first civil disobedience against HB 56 was mostly white people.
She was my support person, you know, to make phone calls. If I ended up in jail, she was going to be the one calling my congregation. She was going to be the one reaching out to my family, letting them know I was arrested, all this kind of stuff.
He was also nervous, and we drove out to Montgomery that day.
She had my stuff.
Like his phone and his, you know, and his keys to his car, because I knew that he might not make it home.
It was a horrible day. It was like a monsoon. You couldn't see, you know, 5 feet ahead of you type of rain. And so we gathered to pray at the State House because a lot of us were people of faith. And we blocked the entranceway to the legislature. And now, of course, you know, you're not supposed to do that.
So Fred was arrested at the State House.
Then, of course, we're all handcuffed, and I think we were singing This Little Light of Mine.
It was moving to me, and it made me cry to see him being arrested, to see him being taken away and standing for something that he believes in.
¿Listos? Sí, se pudo.
Sí, se puede. Sí, se puede.
se puede! Si se puede!
So we had a civil disobedience at the Etowah County Jail, which is also the Etowah County Detention Center. And we protested against that center in particular, but the concept of deportation of immigrants in general.
She said, "Fred, I'm going to be risking arrest. I want to know if you will be there for me like I was there for you." And I said, "Of course I will."
And so the morning of, Fred and I were just checking each other and just saying, like, "All right, you good? Yeah, I'm good. Yeah." I think he gets more nervous because he's a worrywart.
Obama, 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 Obama. Yes, you can.
So we were blockading the front entrance. So once we were chained up and once people started chanting, there was a point where the detainees started to bang on the windows or on the walls, and you could hear that down below.
Immigration system tears families apart.
President Obama, where's your heart?
The immigration system tears families apart. President Obama, where's your heart?
So she gets arrested, and I type on her Facebook page, "I've been arrested. Here's what the bond is. I need you to raise money." As you might have guessed, I'm fairly liberal in my politics. That's not Alabama. So it's lonely. It's lonely. And so she's one of the few friends that I have outside of the congregation here.
I guess outside it is an odd pair, you know, this older white man and then this younger Mexican-American woman. But, I mean, he is part of my family here. I ask him about who he's dating. I tell him about, you know, who I'm seeing. It is that camaraderie of having someone who supports what you're doing and who you support what they're doing. And it makes you feel like you're not crazy because, you know, purposefully being arrested, you know, it's not something that I bring up on everyday conversations.
The story of Gwen and Fred's friendship was brought to us by reporter Ashley Cleek. Coming up on Latino USA.
She would always tell us not to forget where our roots came from and to stand up for ourselves and be strong.
Two generations of women remember an ancestor who inspires them to this day. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Walking down the street, I saw a friendly calling me. Well, I was walking down the street, I saw a friendly calling me. Well, I asked him what he needed. Say, "Come on, let we take a smoke." As I started to smoke, I feel my head started to swell and a body.
"Mama, come and take me home. Come and take me home."
As I start to walk, I feel my head turning around. When I look up in the sky,
as you like the world was coming down. Well, I don't know.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Claudio Sanchez in for Maria Hinojosa, who's working on a TV project premiering on PBS in October. This weekend, we celebrate Mother's Day. While the U.S. celebrates Mother's Day on the second Sunday of May, Mexico honors mothers on a fixed date, May 10th. For people who live on the U.S.-Mexico border, though, getting it right can be tricky. I know. I was born on the border. A place that writer Norma Cantú describes as a wound that's forever healing, although for me, forever, my true home. I grew up in Nogales, Sonora, right across from Nogales, Arizona. Colonia Ingenieros, a working-class neighborhood, was nothing more than a narrow dirt street between two hills, with dozens of homes perched on either side. Our house, three small rooms really, had a tiny garden where my grandmother grew medicinal herbs that she dried, stored, and sold in Coca-Cola bottles. Up to five people could fit if we slept diagonally on the only bed we had. A 30-foot wire allowed us to borrow electricity from the nearest lamppost. When the government cut us off, huge bonfires would blossom at night in the middle of the street, which in turn brought out the barrio historians. Their stories had a special place in Nogales folklore. My favorite was the story of El Bulla, the neighborhood's seemingly amiable baker, El Panadero, whose best bread was sprinkled with the finely crushed bones of disobedient, insolent children. I loved Colonia Ingenieros. Blanca Luz, my mother, did not. All she saw was people imprisoned by their fatalism. My mother's name in English means white light, and yes, her optimism and confidence could light up a room. Not long after my parents separated, my mother grew tired of Nogales. She hated walking through the gauntlet of women peering from behind their long, dark shawls, always murmuring, ¿Y qué de los pobres niños sin padre? Poor kids. Without a father. My mother was a voracious reader with 2 years of college thanks to the philanthropy of an old priest. But in Mexico, her education did not guarantee a job that could sustain our family, let alone pay for good schools. She was convinced that as a single parent, life would be better in the United States, even though it felt like we were poorer in this country than we were in Mexico. My mother could not buy us lots of things, but she surrounded us with lots of books. Every night she would read to us mystery novels, Grimm's fairy tales, and once a week, if I was good, she would bring me a pile of used comic books in both English and Spanish. All the Marvel superheroes, the Lone Ranger, and Pequeña Lulu, a precocious, mischievous little girl not unlike Lucy, Charlie Brown's nemesis. Blanca Luz made sure poverty did not trump education. But here's the key lesson she drilled into us. If you're going to make something of yourself, you must hold on to your dignity as if your life depends on it, she'd say. Your appearance, the way you carry yourself, the precision of your speech, these things matter. Being poor is no excuse for failure. It was a lesson that I began to understand and appreciate as a teen when I started high school in this country. Nogales High was 90% Mexican-American, but speaking English with an accent was a curse. Losing your accent meant that you were ready to move up among the kids who wore their assimilation proudly. Only then could you dare mingle with a few rich kids who ran the school the way their parents ran the city's economy and politics, to their absolute advantage. In high school, I realized that the process of assimilation brings all immigrants to a crossroads, an identity crisis of sorts. I remember wanting desperately to shed my alienhood, but realizing that in this country, I would forever be labeled resident alien, Mexican-American, Chicano, Pocho, Latino, Hispanic, her panic, your panic, our panic, as my mother would often say. I can still hear her laugh. My mother made sure our lives would be forever anchored, not to labels, but to the idea that a love of learning eventually is rewarded. It's an idea that permeates my reporting about struggling families, kids, and schools, because there, but for the grace of God, go I. Happy Mother's Day, Blanca Luz. Gracias. Thanks for showing me how to survive and thrive on both sides of the border. In my 25 years reporting on education, I've found that immigrant kids still face some of the same obstacles that I experienced growing up in this country. Claudia Galindo is an associate professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. In her research, she's found that some of the widely held assumptions about immigrants and education are really cultural misunderstandings.
First, we work with a mainstream definition of parental involvement. For example, some people may say that immigrants are not so involved in their kids' schooling experience, but they are framing their parental involvement from a one-way perspective. Education in the USA is highly related with schooling. However, when we think about some Latino communities, for example, we have the notion of education where we have aspects of schooling, but we also have aspects related with moral child development. So having a kid that is bien educado or way behaved is a very important component for some immigrant parents.
Is that one of the things that we measure?
In the schools?
Yes.
No. And when you think about testing, they don't pay attention to these skills. Following instructions, you know, showing interest in learning, sharing with peers. Those are very important behaviors that kids need to have to learn. Of course, when we're thinking about testing, we don't take into account those aspects.
Because we don't measure that, we often miss the boat.
Yes.
I mean, schools often make assumptions about these children and don't take those things into account, and therefore begin to label children based on some very narrow barometers and criteria.
Yes. It's fascinating. Kids bring to school so much richness, not only in terms of their customs, their traditions, their behaviors, that if teachers could, in some ways, bring those positive aspects into the instruction, into the classroom, we will get much ahead.
You've done some breakthrough research along with UC Berkeley folks that get at the question of whether these kids are ready to learn or not. And that is where that relationship with parents is so crucial.
And that's extremely important, even more, because when we think about Latino communities, on average, they have a different notion of what their role is in the education of their kids. So when I work with some Latino mothers, for example, they think that they are doing the best they can by maintaining a separate environment between the home and the school. So Latino parents, Latino immigrant parents need to know that they need to come to school, and they need to know what are they expected in all this.
Galindo says, ideally, we'd have more people of color going into teaching, but we're a long way off. And in the meantime, there are things schools could be doing. This week, the Center for American Progress and the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers union, reported that while half of the students in public schools are non-white, fewer than one in five of their teachers is non-white. Is that a factor in how effective a teacher can be?
I don't necessarily think that a teacher needs to be Latino to be a good teacher for Latino kids, but I do think that teachers need to have a open perspective in terms of cultural differences. Of course, if you have a Latino teacher, there are some cultural understandings that the teacher already have. So their learning process to deal and to work with these kids is going to be different.
How much of what we've been discussing here, certainly the positive developments in community involvement, parental involvement, is there evidence that it is getting better?
I think in some areas it is. In areas where there's a strong commitment towards community schools and bringing families and the neighborhood into school, things are getting better. But I think schools have a lot of responsibility in this. They need to strongly believe that it's a good investment to bring parents and the communities, and they need to support parents' efforts and respect and appreciate the qualities that parents bring to school.
There's been a lot of research saying Black and Latino students perform substantially less well than their white counterparts. This is what's referred to as the achievement gap. Pedro Noguera is a sociologist at New York University. He thinks we should be framing this disparity in a completely different way.
I would focus primarily on what I and many others now call the opportunity to learn. And by that I mean we have a number of obstacles that limit educational opportunities for children of color, particularly when they're low income. And those have to do with the school conditions, whether the school is safe, whether the school has adequate resources to meet the needs, whether the teachers are well-trained and skilled to meet their needs. Those issues are very, very important, and we don't spend nearly enough time focused on them. We tend to focus on achievement as though it's really just an issue for the student, and we totally overlook the learning environment and the context where learning occurs.
Now, the things that you listed are things that schools, policymakers have some control over. But what about the conditions that schools have no control over? How important are those factors?
Those factors are critical. We know that over 50% of student achievement is influenced by what's happening outside of school. And that includes everything from parental expectations and parental education even. College-educated parents can do more for their children in terms of helping with homework and spending money for private tutors and for summer camp. That really impacts a child. But on top of that, if you're in a neighborhood where there are gangs, where there are environmental hazards, toxic waste, crime, violence, all those things have a negative impact on student learning outcomes. And then when you consider that so many, over 50% of Latino and African-American students right now are attending schools that are not only racially segregated, but segregated by socioeconomic status. That is, we concentrate the poorest kids in the worst schools throughout this country. All of that takes a toll on learning outcomes.
Now, some of your research has suggested that these things are not insurmountable. In your book, Invisible No More, you write that there are more than 3,000 high-performing, high-poverty schools in this country. What are they doing that's different or better to get struggling students to succeed?
Well, schools like those, and these are schools in many cases where they're serving Latino students, many of whom are recent immigrants from the very poorest families. But what they've done is they put in place strategies to meet the learning needs of the students and to address some of the non-academic needs, the social needs, health, safety, mentorship that children bring. And I'll give you one example. I work with a school in the South Bronx. It's a school for recent immigrants. It's a school with a 95% graduation rate. 40% of those kids are undocumented, and they make sure that all of those kids are going into work-related internships so that they will be in productive jobs when they get out of school. It's a very deliberate, focused approach on how to serve students that in other schools would be very at risk and in many cases drop out.
So if we know what works, why isn't it more widespread? Why aren't we seeing more schools do it?
You know, simply put, we don't learn enough from success. We have this kind of generalized narrative out there of failure. What it does is it often reinforces the idea that somehow the parents or the children themselves don't value education. That's not the issue. The real focus should be on how to create more schools that can meet the needs of the kids. If that's where our policymakers were focused, we would enact different kinds of policies than we do now.
Let me raise this more prickly question about race and academic achievement. Is there a link here? Are these two things connected in terms of the outcomes that we're seeing?
Yes, they are connected. They're connected in the data, right? So we can see the correlation. But the source of it really lies in the pervasive stereotypes about race. Stereotypes that reinforce the notion that Latino kids or Black kids are not as smart, that they're better as athletes or better as workers than they are at using their brains. The danger of those stereotypes is that they also influence the attitudes of children themselves. And they reinforce this idea that somehow it's not cool to be smart. And so we see kids who don't read and don't develop habits that reinforce intellectual achievement and cognitive development.
Where are we today in terms of providing every child a quality education in this country?
We are very far from where we should be. We have far too many schools where our kids are either not graduating or if they do graduate, are not prepared for college. We have too many kids going into college who are unprepared. This is a huge problem, and it poses a major challenge to our entire society. And that's what people need to realize. This is not a Latino problem. This is not a Black problem. It's an American problem. Because when large numbers of people are not able to lead productive lives, they're not able to get good jobs, to take care of their families, they become a burden on our economy. And we are not able to grow and develop a society. Older white Americans should be the most concerned about making sure that young Latino and Black children are being well-educated, because it is those children in the years ahead who will be taking care of them.
It's largely an issue of communication. Parents talking to their children's teachers, educators talking with each other, and each of us letting our legislators know where we really want our tax dollars spent. Some parents teach their children through stories and action.
Había una
The sound of rolling out dough triggers fond memories for Yvette Marquez Sharpnack.
My grandma made flour tortillas every single day. I would walk home from school and she would be making tortillas, and I would just pull up a chair and listen to her stories of her childhood while growing up in Mexico.
Yvette's grandmother was Maria de Jesus Mendiaz, or Jesusita. Jesusita was raised on a cattle ranch in Julimes, Chihuahua. She had 9 sisters and a brother who died at birth. Her family thrived until the Mexican Revolution. General Francisco Villa, otherwise known as Pancho Villa, often robbed villagers and seized haciendas and gave the land to soldiers and poor peasants. Yvette and her mother, Vanji Sosa, pick up Jesusita's story in 1916.
Well, I just remember being young and my grandma telling me the stories about a man named Pancho Villa. At the time, I didn't know who he was. I just remember her saying he was not a very nice man. She said when they were small and they knew that the soldiers were coming into town, that the mom had them hiding in the barn because they were afraid of the soldiers coming to rape the young girls.
My 2 oldest aunts, my mother's sisters, they were 17, 16 at the time, and they would hide them because they were in great danger.
They threatened the lives of my grandmother's father and an uncle, and actually had them hanging from a tree and said that, you know, we're taking this ranch. You've got to go. They had to leave right there and then with just the clothes on their back and their horse and carriage.
That night, she said they stayed in the ditches wherever they would take cover, and they hardly slept.
She said it was a very bumpy ride. And she said that they would stop at a ranch and ask them if they can stay there for the night or to eat as they made their journey to Texas.
It was very, of course, very different for them. Presidio, where they crossed from Ojinaga, Mexico, Presidio is a very, very small town. So she would always be very sad about having to come from Mexico.
She only lived in Mexico for 10 years, but yet she was so Mexican.
She would always tell us not to forget where our roots came from and to stand up for ourselves and be strong.
Everybody always asked me, did you grow up eating Mexican food? And it's like, yes, but we never called it Mexican food. It was just food. It was the food that we grew up eating.
That's the biggest thing that she left for me, was food and how to treat people.
She's always a part of me. It's especially in the kitchen. The biggest compliment is for somebody to walk in my kitchen and say, it smells like grandma's house. Just recently, I hosted my family, and one of my cousins said that, and it just brought so much joy.
We had wonderful, wonderful times together, especially on Sundays. Then that's when everybody would come in after Mass, and my mother would be there with a lot of food on the table. And she would always make some soup. And besides that, maybe some green chili. Everybody was so happy. And it was a party every Sunday.
She passed away in 2004. So she lived to be 98 years old.
With such a big family to cook for, Jesusita practically never left the kitchen. Yvette and her mother, Vanji, recently published a cookbook that includes Jesusita's recipes called Muy bueno.
She only spoke Spanish, which she would say, siéntate a comer, está muy bueno, which means, come on and sit down, it's very good.
The story of Jesusita, her daughter, and granddaughter was brought to us by reporter Leslie McClurg. Coming up on Latino USA.
I wasn't going to leave my place of residence and leave my animals behind. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
When pets are the reason domestic violence victims stay. Stay with us. No se vayan.
More passers-by lend their eye to a dog across the street than to a man sitting on the concrete. And I lend you my body. If you lend me forward, small price to pay when you're living like an animal. Let it be right now. Be a happy,
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Claudio Sanchez in for Maria Hinojosa. One of the worst tragedies that can hit a home is domestic violence. When survivors of abuse escape their homes, they often take very little with them. Their children, maybe a few belongings. But what about their pets? In New York City, Latino USA producer Camilo Vargas finds out.
The escape has to be quick, precise, and with little hesitation.
Hello, this is Safe Horizon Hotline.
It usually happens late at night. Victims of domestic violence meet social workers at secret locations or at the nearest police station. If everything goes well, the survivors go into a shelter. But sometimes, a seemingly small detail holds them back. Their pet is still at home, and that's when they call Jenny Coffey.
Hi. You can let them know that I'm a social worker and I can meet them on a street corner.
I'm in a van with Jenny and her partner Debbie Fierro from the Mayor's Alliance for Animals, a local animal rights group.
Beautiful.
They've been helping women escape abusive homes for 7 years. When they started, pets would have to be surrendered at the city's animal shelters. So Jenny would step in to find them a temporary home.
Beautiful.
She gets a call from another social worker about today's case.
There's a woman who has a service dog, and she's been allowed to have her dog with her in the domestic violence shelter. So we picked up some supplies, a dog bed, some dog food, some treats and so forth, and we're going to drop off those and meet the woman and hopefully the dog.
The woman we're meeting escaped after her partner burned down her home.
Hi, April.
The dog is a beautiful black Labrador pit bull mix named April.
What did you want it for?
Look at the nail polish.
Yeah, she gets her nails done.
The owner has epilepsy, so she's been able to keep April as a service dog. But that's the exception.
Originally, the shelters couldn't house pets, and that's true for most shelters right now.
That's Maria Luisa O'Neill from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. She says that fact makes many women stay with their abusers.
They will delay leaving even a very dangerous situation because they knew if they left the pets behind, they would be hurt or killed. Mm-hmm. And that put a lot of people, victims and their children, in danger because they will not leave.
There are close to 2,000 domestic violence shelters in the U.S., but only 86 of them let animals stay with their families. One of them opened its doors in New York a year ago. It's the first pet-friendly shelter in a major U.S. city. And Jenny Coffey helps survivors and their pets get there.
Families don't know that this opportunity exists. So what we really need is a campaign to let families know that they can seek safety now without leaving their pets behind.
The shelter belongs to the Urban Resource Institute, a nonprofit social service group. They partner with the ASPCA and Jenny's group, the Mayor's Alliance for Animals, to create their program. The shelter is a regular apartment building. The clients stay in individual apartments or units. 10 of those are for families with pets. Carly Godwin is here with her 13-year-old son, her Chihuahua Zero, and her cat, Blue.
Nice, Zero.
Godwin and her son waited a year before leaving her abuser.
I wasn't going to leave my place of residence and leave my animals behind. There was no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
When she talked to her son about escaping, he felt the same way.
He would always bring up, what about Blue? What about Zero? I don't want to leave them behind. I don't want to leave them behind. He was very adamant about it.
Running a domestic violence shelter isn't cheap. It's about $12,000 for an average four-month stay. It's $300 to $1,000 for a pet. City funds will pay for people. They won't pay for animals. So shelters like this one look for funding from other organizations. Purina donated an indoor dog park so Carly Godwin can walk her dog without compromising her safety.
It looks like a kid's park. They have ramps, stairs, blocks they can climb up on. It's beautiful. It's all painted back here, flowers and all that stuff on the cement.
It's a family outing of sorts.
I have three sons. This is my cat, my dog, and my real son. My human son.
Being part of the family means pets can also be targeted for abuse. Pamela Isaac came here with her three cats. One of her previous partners tortured another cat she had.
He used to take my cat and hang him out the window.
Then he set her apartment on fire and killed the cat.
But he had smoke inhalation, and a couple of days after the fire, he had to be euthanized because they couldn't save him.
Studies show domestic violence and animal cruelty go hand in hand. A majority of pet-owning survivors say their abusers targeted their pets, too.
It's definitely control. They do anything so you will comply with what they want.
Pets can be vulnerable to abuse, but they can also be powerful healers as their owners put their lives back together. Take Ana Puerta. That's not her real name. She's here with her two dogs.
Say hi, Tony. Say hi.
Puerta's partner kicked her out of her home after breaking one of her legs. She's still in a cast. She stayed with her mother temporarily before a social worker found the pet shelter. The night she brought her dogs here, she let them run around and said to them,
"This is what we're going to be for now, and you know, I want you guys to be comfortable, and you know."
And in the quiet of her new home, the dogs began to play.
And that's one of the things that made me feel almost immediately like I just sat down and I was just like, oh.
That was the first step in her healing process.
Let me see if I can get him to do his little piggy sounds. Come here, Tony. Oh my goodness.
Researchers say that animals can trigger feelings and brain responses in humans that are just like the ones we have for close relatives.
The role that my little babies play in that is that they help me to see me. They're my mirror. Having a mirror in front of you is the best way for you to see, you know, who you are and what your next steps are.
The next steps are the hardest, especially for low-income survivors. Women like Ana Puerta have about 6 months to look for new jobs and a new home for them and their pets. Until then, they're in good, non-human company. For Latino USA, I'm Camilo Vargas in New York.
The Animal Welfare Institute has a database with hundreds of programs around the country that can help domestic violence survivors with their pets. To find out more, visit latinousa.org.
Porque yo nada más estoy esperando que ellos vengan, porque yo no puedo ir.
I'm here just waiting for my kids to visit, she says. I can't go to them.
Earlier, we heard the story of three siblings in Oregon whose mother was deported more than 2 years ago. The Tapia children were left in the care of their undocumented grandmother and still live with her today. Their mother, Liliana Ramos, moved to Tijuana, Mexico, a city she had never lived in and where she knew no one. Jordana Gustafson brings us her story.
Liliana Ramos has a routine that she follows without fail. Every day when I first wake up, she says, I thank God for giving me another day. I pray for my children, she says, and I look at the weather. I look at the weather here, and I look at the weather there. When the temperature in Bend, Oregon recently dipped below zero, she sent text messages to each of her children. She told Brian to put on a hat. She says he's 21, but she never stopped being a mom. She told Ashley to take care of herself, but she said she was most worried about her youngest, Carlene. Because you know how kids are. They say, I'll just wear a sweatshirt.
Los niños no tienen frío. Una chamarrita sencillita. No, yo...
Ramos has seen her children just a handful of times since she was deported in September 2011. She knows that parents of college kids may not see their children any more often, but she says for her, it's different.
Porque yo nada más estoy esperando que ellos vengan, porque yo no puedo ir.
I'm here just waiting for my kids to visit, she says. I can't go to them. Ramos was given a deportation order in 2005 after her asylum application was rejected. She ignored the order until immigration agents found her at work in 2011. She had 9 months to leave the country. When she headed south, Ramos says, her sense of loss overwhelmed her.
Me acuerdo que la muchacha manejó todo el tiempo porque, o sea, yo nada más quería dormir.
She says the other driver drove the whole way because she just wanted to sleep. She says there's a sadness when you leave something behind.
Dejar algo atrás.
That sadness is evident even at this joyous-sounding Christmas gathering. Here at the U.S.-Mexico line, families split by deportation press up against either side of the border fence. They sing to each other through the thick iron mesh. Some chat quietly, others cry. Mari Galvan is here today. She's a social worker at a shelter in Tijuana that takes in deported women. She says the majority of the women arrive suffering emotional shock because they've just been separated from their children. They don't know what will happen or when they'll see them again. Galvan says many of the women lose their children to state custody in the U.S. when they're deported. Others find a relative or a friend to care for them. These are mothers who can't sleep at night, she says, because they don't know if their relative is treating their kids well or if the friend bathed their kids before putting them to bed. She says they feel totally powerless.
Ellas se sienten totalmente desprotegidas y sienten una impotencia de saber.
These are the feelings that enveloped Ramos when she arrived. Ramos says her faith in God has gotten her through, but it's more than that. She laughs often and insists on a bright outlook on life. She's also savvy. She landed an accounting job at a fruit and vegetable distributor, even though she didn't graduate from high school, and she found a small home in a safe neighborhood for half the going rate. Ramos makes it a point to give back. Twice a month, she drives her old Jeep with expired Oregon plates off the main road and into a cement canal near an overpass. On this Sunday morning, two of her kids are visiting from Oregon. They join about a dozen Christian volunteers in feeding hundreds of homeless people who wait patiently in five long lines. Like Ramos, the majority of them were forced to leave the U.S. As volunteers pass out steaming styrofoam cups of pozole, Ramos carries a clipboard and asks questions. She asks if they've been deported, do they have children in the U.S., and are they in touch with them. If she has credit on her phone, she may let them use it to call relatives in the U.S. If anyone has plans to cross the border again, Ramos warns them of the danger. She says she tells them to try to make a life here in Tijuana. She tells them she was also deported and that her kids are in the U.S. They're surprised, she says. She thinks it has a particularly strong impact on them because she's a woman and she's alone. Later that day, Ramos takes her kids Brian and Carlene out to eat. Ramos showers them with hugs and kisses when they're here. They walk with their arms around each other. 13-year-old Carlene hangs on her mother's neck. In Oregon, she often seems wiser than her years, but here with her mom in Mexico, she gets to be a kid again. She complains about the food. Ramos isn't sure if she'll ever get a visa to enter the U.S. again. There's talk of all three kids moving to San Ysidro, just on the other side of the border, so they can be close, or of Carlene moving to Tijuana for high school. Every day Ramos is here is a day she doesn't get to see her kids grow up. But these visits, she says, give her strength to go on. For Latino USA, I'm Jordana Gustafson in Tijuana, Mexico.
There are lots of things that come to mind when you think about the daily lives of famous musicians. Changing diapers isn't one of them. But artists, of course, are often parents, too. Take, for instance, Chilean rapper Ana Tiju. Last year, she gave birth to her second child, a baby girl. And the experience deeply impacted the writing and tone of her most recent album, Vengo. Ana Tiju brings us today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom.
My name is Ana Tiju, and I am a musician, lyricist, mother, and I think that's it. With that, it's a lot.
Vengo en busca de respuestas con el manojo lleno y las venas abiertas. Vengo como un libro abierto, ansiosa de aprender la historia no contada de nuestros ancestros.
To be a mother, it's changed everything. I always say that it's like to punch you in your face. Everything that used to be like important seems not so important anymore. So I think all this love that you suddenly got begin to be super inspirative for everything that you do, in my case with music. The album Vengo is a new baby. He's like a kid, he's got to walk by himself. Antipatriarca, that is a song that talks about women, is a very feminist song. That song has been like inspired by my mother and her struggle and the struggle of every woman. And I will say also the song Emilia that I made for my little baby. My mother, her name is Maria Emilia, and she always told me like, one day if you get a little girl, please put Emilia. And of course, her name is Emilia Victoria because my father tell me like she could call her Victoria. Okay, Emilia Victoria, let's go for it. And I love it, to be honest. So the name has been put in by my parents.
Y si lo alto estoy, seguro que será por ti.
I'm very proud that she got the name of my mother. I think family is the most revolutionary mini society that you can have. I've met in my life so many people that got political discourse or whatever about life, and when you meet their kids, like, they abandon them, you know? So I think that the family is like the application of everything that we say and we do. I learn to laugh about myself all the time. Because I think in this work, like, we can be stupid sometimes and be blind and feel that we are important. So, for example, my kid right now, he say that my music is old music. And he said that Damian Marley is cool and I'm not cool at all. So he's always making joke about me, even if he support me and he's know all the song. That's funny, I love it. Like, that puts a vision about you, like, very different, a different position. I hope that I'm doing a good work. It's so hard to be a mother. It's more hard than be a musician, an artist, and all that crap. I think that's the real work.
Y es que estamos tú y yo ya amarraditas por un lazo maternal de arterias y de vitaminas.
Chilean hip-hop artist Ana Tijoux on music and motherhood. Ana's recent album, Vengo, is available from Nacional Records. That's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, and Camilo Vargas. I'm NPR's Claudio Sanchez, in for host and executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to Dustin DeSoto. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Where are you?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, supporting the Ronald McDonald House Charities, the National Braille Press, and NPR. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.